Let's start advancing freedom.
Good evening and welcome to the Freedom 21 radio program. My name is Roy Avila and we are going to have an exciting show for you this evening. The first part of the show is going to be a guest from Wisconsin. It's Greg Swank. And he's going to report on how the anti-poverty smart growth agenda, also called comprehensive planning, is being rejected county by county in the state of Wisconsin. The state legislature has now repealed state funding of smart growth, and that just goes to show you that citizens can make a difference. And in the second hour, it's going to be part three of War on Reason. Dr. Edwin Vieira will be talking about how the central bank controls the monetary system around the world. You'll be able to understand how this insider system, fiat money, benefits the powerful, harms citizens, and destroys constitutional government, ensures economic decay, and the risks of economic collapse. We also want to tell you about the Freedom 21 conference that's coming up later this month. It's going to be in Reno, and let me just grab this little note here. 6th Annual Freedom 21 Conference is going to be held at the Nugget in Reno, July 14th through the 16th. And if you want more information, you can check out the web at freedom21.net. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back.
While some of our affiliate stations take a commercial break, let me take a few moments to tell the rest of you a bit about Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a freedom policy center that celebrates the principles of self-governance and individual liberty which inspired the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States of America. It's a group of individuals who advance the freedom of all by promoting and strengthening the practice of constitutional administration in local, state, and national government. The Freedom 21 Santa Cruz mission is to advance the principles of freedom to individuals, community, and government through public discourse, community outreach, and grassroots education programs. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. Objectives of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz and its participants include the following. Focus public attention on the value of the freedoms guaranteed to Americans by the Constitution of the United States of America, and encourage individual and community interest in protecting those freedoms. Provide opportunities for political discourse among organization membership and the community. Promote and strengthen government responsiveness to the principles of freedom. Educate the public about local, national, and international threats to individual freedom and the U.S. Constitutional Republic. Invite Americans to unite against the advance of international collectivist movements that cause poverty, oppression, and a degraded earth. And to create a model for successfully promoting and ensuring U.S. constitutional government in a local community. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
We'll be right back.
As a listener of tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, you have exclusive access to our online audience participation center at freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Here are just some of the value-added features you'll get by logging on while you're tuned in. Get free access to the research and articles that have contributed to tonight's show. See an important multimedia presentation titled The Philosophy of Liberty. Email the host with your comments. Get special discounts on featured books like the ever-popular Pocket Constitution. Register to receive a free subscription to AdvancedBulletin.net, which provides commentary and analysis on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. So get more. Log on while you're tuned in and advance freedom at freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Policies, procedures, and laws enacted by local government and non-government organizations in the name of diversity, community, and earth are diminishing individual liberty, degrading ecology, and threatening human life and happiness in towns across the nation. You've likely already experienced some of the consequences of policies that are approaching full implementation, with little public discourse or voter input. Have you experienced any of the following? Restricted freedom of mobility as you sit for hours in gridlock traffic. Mounting limitations on, or even loss of, your private property. An engineered housing crisis that you're being told must be solved with your money by those who caused it. Loss of parental authority to a government education system that seems to emphasize social indoctrination over education. Transitioning of water resources to regional control by non-elected bureaucrats with subsequent engineered shortages. Heavy influence of international and non-government organizations over local policy at the expense of representative democracy. You're not alone in recognizing these and other symptoms of our diminishing freedoms. The adverse consequences of collectivist policies and laws enacted by local government bodies are affecting almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back to Freedom 21 Radio Santa Cruz, and our guest this evening is Greg Swank with Take Back Wisconsin. Greg, you there?
Yeah, I sure am.
How are you tonight?
I'm doing just fine. It's a beautiful evening here in Wisconsin, nice and cool.
Well, I've really been excited to talk to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a young fella, you know, about 53 years old.
In the prime.
Yeah, married, have four children, one daughter in college and three still at home. I got a later start in life there. And, I've pretty much done, my life has just been an incredible life. Filled with all kinds of twists and turns and wonderful journeys and, Take Back Wisconsin and the plight of the property owners here in Wisconsin has taken up a lot of my life in the last 5 years.
Well, how did you fall into it?
Actually, it started here locally with a group that we formed called the Wood County Property Owners Association, and they had asked me to be their vice president, and I started with that group to fight something on a county level regarding holding tanks in our county. It's totally removed from what we're talking about, but basically it was property rights violation where they wanted to charge holding tank owners a special fee for reporting and basically pay for their secretarial work. But aside from that, during that 2-year process of battling and court battles between the county and the property owners, somebody had tapped me on the shoulder and asked me if I had heard about smart growth in the state of Wisconsin, and I said no, I hadn't, and they filled me in a little bit. They really didn't have a whole lot of information on it either, and they asked me to look into it. So I did, And what I found, and completely, if you've seen my picture on the website, you can see that I now have white hair. It was black before I read the legislation that was passed on smart growth. And what we were doing with the holding tanks was absolutely small potatoes compared to what was coming down the pike, and the flags went up and everything. So we just started digging in. Some folks from other parts of the state had heard that I had been speaking on several different issues, and I tagged up with I'm in Wood County here in Wisconsin, and right next door is Portage County. Right across the county line is a tax assessor who I heard was speaking about smart growth, so I made a call to him, and the rest was history. From that point on, we traveled from as far north as Bayfield, Wisconsin, all the way down to Madison and all points in between, talking to groups of 300, 400, 500, 600 people at a pop, putting together meetings and organizing counties and towns and people to bring them out and let them hear what was going on.
Well, what was it about, I guess, your research that kept you involved and, you know, got you to the point that you are today?
Well, the law here in Wisconsin, and I'm sure it's the same just about anywhere else you go, the law here in Wisconsin was kind of brought in through a whole different avenue. First of all, and by they, I mean the special interest groups. We had 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin. We had the Home Builders Association, the Realtors Association, special interest groups that were putting this together, the American Planners. And what they did was they brought this initially to the senators, a couple of the senators on the floor, and they said, hey, take a look at this legislation or this what we're proposing here to be legislation and tell us what you think. Well, the senators at that time looked at it and they said, no, there is absolutely no way that this would even make it out of committee, let alone stand the test of time or the public scrutiny. It would never make it. We're not even going to entertain this. So the next thing we know is what we do is we have this law slipped into the budget package in 1999 and 2000. So we received smart growth on our doorstep through a budgetary process. And it was that particular process that really, really upset me. Not just what the law was doing to property owners in the state, but the process of getting the law without my representative having a clear vote on how this goes. And yes, I understand the argument is that they passed the budget, therefore, and blah, 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 but everybody knows the difference between budgetary process and due process. So that was the catalyst. That was the catalyst. That's what sprung me into action, and me and several other people around the state, and we just got busy, and we just started really ripping into this thing. And, you know, it's like anything else. Once you get excited about something, and the further and further you go, and the deeper you dig, and the more you uncover, you realize that not only is this a law that's damaging to the state, our property owners, it violates our state constitution, it's big money, it's big government, it's big brother, it's a cookie cutter approach to centralizing zoning in the state of Wisconsin. And it's really been a rough ride, but an enjoyable journey.
So how long have you been at it?
I've been at it since 2001.
Talk about, you know, what it's like that the more you learn and, you know, the more research you do, that how it becomes even bigger than Wisconsin.
Well, yeah, it's obvious. For those who are listening, if you want to see the origins of how all of this came about and really get into depth on it, I would strongly recommend going to takebackwisconsin.com. There's a lot of the preliminary work and the research and articles that have precipitated over these past 4 years are all out there, and it really is quite involved. But to answer your question, first of all, this is a global effort. This wasn't Tommy Thompson, our governor in Wisconsin, one day scratching his head saying, you know, we really need to do something different. Let's have sustainable development. Let's have something we'll call comprehensive planning. This was something that was in the makings through the Clinton administration. And, you know, the interesting thing is I always get this when I'm talking. I get this partisanship argument that, you know, it was the Republicans that did this or it was the Democrats that did this. This is smart growth or comprehensive planning, as we call it here in Wisconsin, is a nonpartisan issue. This particular law was generated by President Bush Sr. when he signed the Agenda 21 treaty, and it was followed up and put into action and through executive order by the Clinton administration. This is by no stretch of the imagination a partisan issue. This is the power struggle at the top working its way through the U.S. government. It's the environmentalist groups. It's the extremists on both sides of the coin. It's the United Nations. It's an agenda being pushed from outside of the U.S. in order to bring, I believe, to bring some kind of equity. So what we'll end up eventually having is a centralized government that controls our property, controls the way we live and what we can do with that. In the state of Wisconsin, what we're seeing here through like the City Alliance of Cities, and on their website, they make no bones about it. They would like to see our local governments shut down, our county government, our town government. Now, your listeners need to understand that Wisconsin is one of those few bastions of, well, actually, it's not a bastion. It's just one of the few remaining states that has local town governments. Every town has their government, and we have local towns, villages, and cities, and we have that structure still in place through our Constitution. So we're trying to hang on to that, and it's been a real battle.
When you started to uncover these things, mm-hmm. How did you feel? What did you think?
Betrayed, angry. I scratched my head. I mean, I could not. First of all, the hardest part for me on all of this was, and especially when I was out speaking in the public arena, the hardest thing for me to get through was that this came directly through the UN. I really, really, really had a difficult time with that. But the more I uncovered, when I went back to 1976, then I looked at the language from Habitat 1, and you start following it through, and you look at the timeline for global governance, and you see how all of these pieces all fit in, and how these treaties and the Wetland and the Environmental and the Endangered Species Act and all of these acts and all of these treaties, how they are conglomerations of multiple countries and people coming together to form these, and how that starts to shift into the United States, and how we end up with biospheres, and how we end up with our national parks being you drive into a national park and it has a UN banner on it. I mean, all of these things just started to really make sense, and the more I learned in it, and you can go to the UN website at any time, they make absolutely no bones about it. Everything is there. They talk exclusively about what they're doing with Agenda 21, comprehensive planning, well, or smart growth, whatever you want to call it. There's different names for it in different areas of the world. In Australia, it's called one thing. In the UK, it's another. In France, they call it a little something different. In Germany, it's something different. But it's all sustainable development. And that was the hardest thing for me to get my mind around, that this was actually being puppeted. The puppeteers were at the UN, and this is how it was flowing through the environmentalist groups. And in speaking to the public on that, what I found here in the state of Wisconsin is that people are not going to listen to you trying to explain to them that the UN is in their backyard. They just do not want to hear that. They don't want to get their minds around it. Now, it's not everybody, but for me, when I was preparing my speeches and my slide presentations and all that kind of stuff, The thing that I tried really, really hard was to get this UN message out there, but it just was backfiring big time.
I think it seems like it's a big pill for people to swallow.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. It's kind of, you know, it's a denial thing, I think. And I don't quite understand it because, you know, when I, one-on-one, what happens normally after one of those UN discussions is, I usually end up with a small group of people that are huddled around me that are saying, you know what? We've known this for years, and, you know, it's about time somebody says this. But for the most part, the masses are just really nervous about it. And it's hard. I try to explain to them in my presentation, look, don't be frightened by the fact that the UN is involved in this. Think about it for a second. Where is the United Nations headquarters? And I try to bring them home. You know, it's in New York. I try to point it out that that in 1945 we signed this declaration to join the UN, and we're a part of that, and they're a part of us, and it's all global. But they just don't want to hear that. So for the most part, for the last 2.5 years, I've pretty much eliminated that from my when I speak in public. I pretty much eliminate that discussion from the top, unless of course somebody prompts me to talk about it, or maybe afterwards we talk about it. But there is so much more information just on a local level, just on our state level, that these people have absolutely no idea that they're just sheep being led to slaughter.
I think one thing that you had talked about earlier was how it's presented differently to different people in different areas, but it's all the same thing. What I found quite useful going to your website was that glossary on how to interpret the language.
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the funny thing is what was interesting for me is when we started going from county to county and town to town, well, there was all kinds of things that, you know, we were met by opposition by some people, but for the most part, we were welcomed. And we're talking about looking, what we would do is, if we were going to go into a different county or a different town in a different county, what we would do is we would order their comprehensive planning. What does your plan look like currently? You know, tell us how you put it together. Send us any of the information you got, and we'll research this. And so when we come, we're better prepared to discuss what's happening in your backyard, not just my backyard. So what we were finding out is that the language, this cookie-cutter approach to centralizing this zoning in the state of Wisconsin, or taking over basically your property, every plan was identical. I mean, in some cases, you could go to one town in a county and another town in another county, and in some cases, you could turn to page 125 in their plan and 125 in their plan, and they would be identical.
Wow.
The language was being used because what they would do is they would hire these consultants to come in. Well, where did the consultants come from? They're either ex-planners, they're part of the American Planner Association, or they're professors, or, you know, somebody who got together, but somehow they're usually or normally linked or have been linked to the American Planners Association. And those people are providing the information for these plans. So the recipes for sending out, while everybody has to send out a survey and get the input from the public.
So they can have consensus, right?
Yeah, those surveys are exactly the same from one town to the other. Well, once you start showing people that you're being duped, oh, do they get angry. They don't like the fact that that they've been had. You know, I don't know if anybody in the listening audience has ever watched this movie. It's called The Day After. Have you seen it, Roy?
No, I haven't.
Oh, there's one scene in there. It's great. New York City. The kid is the son of the climatologist is in the center of this storm, and his father calls him and tells him that whatever you do, stay inside, because if you go out into the storm, it's going to get worse, and everybody is going to die because the temperature will drop to sub 175 below zero in like 15 seconds, and everybody's going to be killed. So stay inside. There's 200 or 300 people in this room, and one of the police officers gets up and he says, "I think we need to start walking and get out of here. The snow's getting deep. We'll never get out." He convinces the people to leave. The kid stands up and he sees that they're all walking towards to their death, and he's pleading with them that it's going to get worse. They're going to die if they go out there, and they just totally ignore him and walk by him. That's the scenario that plays out perfectly here in Wisconsin when you talk about this. But what's happened, these people were led, but the fortunate thing was is that the storm didn't get worse. We got in there before they left the building, and we were able to say, "Hey, look, he's not kidding. You got to turn around. You've got to take your town back. You've got to do something here."
Talk about how it started with you in taking back your town.
Well, my town, fortunately, my town and my county are I'm blessed. I live in a county where the planners here have put it in writing that they will not participate in this program. They're taking the wait-and-see approach. They're thinking that there's going to be major problems in Madison. They don't like the idea of the grant money that, and all of the conditions that are attached to that grant money. So they pretty much bowed out of it. Our town has their own comprehensive plan, if you will, but it's nothing binding, and it's certainly not an ordinance or limiting us to our land use. But for me personally, seeing other towns and helping other towns, here's a really good example. We just had today's Wednesday. It would have been last Sunday. We spoke at a town 45 minutes south of here, a really small town of only about 250 people. They had no zoning in their town for 120 years, I'm just guessing, for a very long time. And here comes Smart Growth. Well, the county comes in and tells them that if you don't do your plan, the state's going to do it for you, and it's mandatory, and it's got to be done by 2015, and there's stiff penalties if you don't do it. But if you want grant money, we can get you grant money, and we can help you work your plan. The only problem is that you don't have village powers. So you have to have village powers in order to be used to do land use management or zoning. So they vote themselves village powers. And they go ahead for the last 2 years with their plans. Well, there were some people in that group that were pretty upset, and they were following this whole process, and they've been keeping their ear to the ground, and they've learned about Smart Growth, and they started asking questions, and they started raising issues, and it started getting backlash. So lo and behold, they were getting a pretty good head of steam up, but they just couldn't convince and pull in enough people. So they called myself and Dan Milkey, and we went down there on a Sunday evening. We spoke for 2 hours, and on Monday night, they passed 4 resolutions at their town board meeting, a special town board meeting. They pulled the village powers. They pulled village powers and returned their town government back to general powers. They passed a motion that said we will not participate ever in Smart Growth. They passed a motion that we will not be a part of county zoning. And they passed a motion, I forgot what the fourth one was. Anyway, they passed all 4 of these motions in one night. And what they had in that town that night, I think there was 123 people at that town hall. Wow. Normally, if you go to a town meeting anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, there's the 5 people in the front and maybe another 5 if you're lucky in the back.
Wow, that must have made you feel pretty good.
Well, we've often been, our approach has been a little bit different. Well, we've been, we know what the state law is. We know what the grant money is for.
Explain that. Talk about the grant money. I think that's key.
Yeah, the grant money is key because without the grant money, nobody moves. If the grant money is the magic stick. I hear music playing. Are we going to...
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk some more. We just wanted to let people know and remind them that the Freedom 21 conference is coming up in Reno in a week or so, and you can learn a lot there. So we'll take a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Greg Swank from Take Back Wisconsin and how he's and his community is dealing with the whole smart growth issue. Talk about the grant money and the strings that are tied to it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the grant money is the whole crux behind all of this. The grant money is... Here's how the normal process works from county to town. First of all, the grant money is money that my town or any town can apply for individually, and depending on the size of your town depends on how much money you get. The little town that we just worked on, they received a grant for $17,000, and then you have to have the matching funds. So there's a matching funds clause in there. So for them it was $34,000 out of their pocket. But what they do is normally they say the county will come to you and say, if the county has a multi-jurisdictional plan, which means that they can, in our, let's say Portage County, they were the first county in our state to do this. They had 26 towns, I believe, 23 or 26. They went to all 26 towns and they said, look, we're going to help you develop your plan. You have to do this. If you don't, the government's going to do it. It's going to cost you a fortune if you try to do it on your own. We can help you. We can get the grant money. Sign here. So they signed up everybody, and they got a multi-jurisdictional grant for something like $770,000.
Well, where does the grant money come from?
The grant money comes from the state coffers. And as everybody knows, grant money is not just, there's not a tree in Wisconsin that we don't have a grant tree here where it has grant dollars. It's taxpayer dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out of the coffers, and they manipulate it through. It was, remember, this was passed in a budget bill. So the estimated cost of the Smart Growth Plan in just Wisconsin for the first phase of it is $100 million. And it's $4 million a year for the first part of it, and then it's it up until 2010, all of this money is taken care of. But anyway, it came through the budget plan. So what they do is now that the county's got this multi-jurisdictional thing going, and they've got towns scared to death and under their thumb, they go ahead and apply for the grant money. So the grant money is a huge part of it. Now, some counties are pretty good about it, but most counties, Portage County was a real good example. They immediately hired more staff. They bought more computers. They bought graphing equipment, ink, paper, whatever it takes, because they were anticipating that they were going to have all of this additional equipment.
Hold that thought for just a second. We're going to take a break. Continue the discussion right after this.
All right.
Welcome back. We're talking with Greg Swank from Take Back Wisconsin on how smart growth and sustainable development is funded. So go ahead and continue on the grant process.
Okay, so once you have the grant money, see, the thing is that as a town, we have to sign on to that particular contract with the county. The county then files with the state, and the state grants the county the contract. However, most people don't know what they've signed, have never seen a copy of the contract, nor have they seen the grant proposal. The grant proposal comes with 14 additional attachments to it. Under comprehensive planning law in Wisconsin, we have 9 elements that have to be met. Under the grant proposal, you have 14 additional things that you have to meet as well, specific items to fulfill that grant process. And that's where a lot of the counties and a lot of the towns started to back off when they saw that not only do we have to do the 9 things that the law is requiring, we also have to do the 14 things to get the grant money going. And combining those two things together was really obviously a burden on what it was going to be for the local communities and the property owners. Needless to say, this started in 1999 in the state of Wisconsin, and as I don't know if you've talked about this before I got on the air or not, but as of 3 weeks ago, our Joint Finance Committee in the state of Wisconsin voted 10-6 to repeal smart growth, and that is on the governor's desk today.
Wow.
Now, I don't know what the governor is going to do. We don't know. There's been some rustling about it. We know that we've seen letters from the governor that we've solicited stating that he was in favor of smart growth, but the way that the Joint Finance Committee wrote this into the budget, see, it I just love the poetic justice here, because we got it through the budget and they're taking it out through the budget. The worst case scenario in the state of Wisconsin right now is that once the budget passes, it's the worst case scenario is there's no more funding for smart growth.
Wow.
That's it. So if you cut off the head of the beast, you know, you've pretty much got a pretty good shot at it. Now, I'm not sure cutting the funding is going to cut off the head. It may only be take out a limb or part of the body here, but it's certainly...
I'm sure it'll try to regrow itself somewhere.
Yeah, it's a huge blow, because for the next 2 years, nobody can file for funding. So, you know, we have that there. Now, the other side of it is the way that the The way I understand it is when I talk to the folks that put this bill forward, the way they wrote this into the budget, they did it in such a way that if the governor tries to veto it by using his line item veto powers, if he tries to line item veto this, he's going to have to literally black out huge sections of it. And by doing so, they've included a lot of his pet projects in there.
Mm-hmm.
So if he was to line item the smart growth section and reinstate it, he would also eliminate a lot of the funding and projects that he has personally put into the budget. So this could really be dead on the vine. The other side of that coin is that if we manage here in the state of Wisconsin to kill the smart growth comprehensive law, what we have immediately in the wings is the same group of people that instituted the smart growth law are now busy and working and have already in place a whole another set of legislations that they would like to run through, which is basically a disguised version of comprehensive planning under a different guise. So this is not going to go away. This is not going to be like if we were to win this battle, we're going to be well on our way and we'll never have to deal with this. It's going to keep coming back and coming back. It's just the nature of the beast here.
I remember when we talked on the phone prior to doing this, you were saying initially that, you know, Wisconsin embraced smart growth and things were just rolling right along. What do you think made people turn?
It's basically the only thing that makes people turn is information. You know, it's like anything else, and I'm sure it's the same out in Santa Cruz. I'm sure it's the same way in Boston. You walk down the street, you ask 10 people who their senator or state representative is, they couldn't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care. Smart growth was one of the things we have here in Wisconsin. We're blessed with being one of the highest tax states in the nation. And whenever the government puts together a mandate, and especially if it's unfunded, it really starts raising a lot of eyebrows. But one of the biggest impacts that people have felt over the years in the state, and that's why I was the vice president and later the president of the Wood County Properties Owners Association, is because we were starting to feel that our property rights were going by the property taxes. I live on an 80-acre farm here in Rudolph, and the taxes have tripled since I've been here. So when we see things that laws or legislations that are going to be affecting the cost of my property and see that cost escalate even more through more restrictions and those types of things, then we become concerned. And when people are informed, America is an amazing country. People may be apathetic and they may be lethargic on political issues. They may not take an active role in their local government. They may not take an active role in their local schools, which is a sad commentary on where we're heading. On the other side of that coin is if you inform them, if you get them to a point where they can see clearly what's happening, they are a resilient group of people. And that's what we're seeing in Wisconsin. Now, you also have to understand in Wisconsin that we have 72 counties in this state. 49 of the counties are low-density counties. 70% of our population lives in 23 counties. So we have we have 49 counties here that are very low population, low density, a lot of woods, a lot of farmland. And what's necessary for Milwaukee may not be that same law may not apply or even be remotely connected to that little 250 population town that we just went through. Trying to explain affordable housing and in boundaries and all of this type of stuff in Milwaukee or Madison or Green Bay or someplace in a larger city, larger area, that might be something that, you know, you can sit down and logically work through. But in Vilas County, where you have more cows than people, it just doesn't work.
Well, and I think even when you look, even in big cities like that, when you look behind the screen,
yep,
it doesn't even work there.
You're exactly right. You know, what they keep touting, and that's, and we pointed this out in our speaking engagements often. We had the city people stand up in the crowd and kind of give us a hard time about, you know, well, we have to do this, we have to protect our environment, we have to be conservative, or we have to be concerned about conservation and environment and energy and renewable resources and all this kind of stuff. And this is coming from people who live in the city,
mm-hmm.
who live by a different set of rules, who have a double standard applied to their way of life. Because out here in the country, if I wanted to build a home on a lake, by golly, I've got to jump through all kinds of hoops with the DNR. I've got to have setback rules. I've got to have buffer zones. I've got to have all of this stuff going on. In the city, you can pave right up to the river. You can build a house right, I mean, you can build that. We've got more and more houses, boat houses, everything. In the city, everything changes. Out in the country, boy, if you fertilize your farmland and it runs off into the river, you're in big trouble. But in town, you can dump as much fertilizer on your ground all year round just to, you know, to keep that grass green and make sure that you keep those sprinklers going. You know, there's a whole different set of rules went from the people that live in the country and the people that live in the town.
Yeah, and, go ahead.
And that's wherein lies the difference. And what we try to point out to people, if planning, nobody's arguing about whether or not my little town of Rudolph should plan or not. Of course not. We plan. Cities plan. But what we see in cities is the results of what planning is. We see what civil and city engineers and people with the best intentions in the world planned 25 years ago. And that's what they want us to do now. They want us to plan for 20 to 25 years out. And 25 years ago, when they put that street in, where they put that street in and how they put that street in is an abomination today, because it created all kinds of unintended consequences as things started to expand around that street. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Just as an example. So when you go into a town and you say, oh my God, look at the one-way streets, and how come this twists here, and how come this goes this way? That's your planning.
Well, I think
they were trying to think ahead, but they ran into a problem down the road, and they said, well, gee, how are we going to fix that? Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do is we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we'll just put this boulevard in here, and that'll rectify that. And then, you know, 10 years down the road, they're going, oh my gosh, dude, we got a mess here. And see, that's the compilation of unintended consequences that comprehensive planning does. Not only does it strip your property rights away, not only does it try to remove the people that live in the country and move them to the cities and get that diversity and equity. See, what we have in the state of Wisconsin is so similar to every place else. You can go to the Alliance of Cities in Wisconsin and read on their website. They don't make any bones about it. I mentioned this earlier. They're trying to get rid of our local and county government. What they want is regional government. And the reason they want that is because the tax base is leaving the cities, and they're leaving the cities in droves. All of these suburban areas are starting to pop up out in rural America, and they can't stand it. They're losing their tax base. So in order to get their tax base back, the first thing one of our governors did when he was elected was try to tell the people in Wisconsin that local government is way too expensive. It costs way too much money to have local government. We have to get away from it. Well, that backfired on them. So the drive is there. So now they're saying, okay, well, maybe we can't get that away. So what else can we use? Well, smart growth works perfectly for raising the cost of property in the country. So if we can raise the cost of property in the country up so high that the only people that are going to be able to afford to live out there are the affluent, yeah, so we lose a few affluent, but look at the tax base we're going to get back in the cities. So this is not everybody that says that they're a proponent. When they tell me they're a proponent of smart growth, well, the builders associations are proponents of smart growth, I say, wait a minute, what's in it for you? Why would the builders be interested in smart growth? Well, if you do the research and you dig a little bit, you find out in the state of Wisconsin they released $465 million of Fannie Mae money for, guess what? Affordable housing. What does every town in the state of Wisconsin have to have? In their plan, under comprehensive planning, they have to address affordable housing. Where are you going to, where is your property designated for affordable housing in the town of ABC, Wisconsin?
And the irony, I think, of it is it becomes less affordable. Government is involved.
Oh, yeah, it does. The only people that get rich are the people that come in to build. They come in and they tell you, well, I'll tell you what, you have to have affordable housing here because it's in your plan. We're going to do you a favor. We're going to do it for you.
Yeah.
And we're even going to take care of the maintenance on them.
Oh, sure. What we're seeing out here is people get involved in these affordable housing projects and with government subsidies, and, you know, they live in a place for, you know, 5 or 6 years. They feel like they've built some equity, and they go, oh, right, I'm in the game. I'm going to now sell my house and move up.
Oh, yeah.
Then they go to sell their house, and they say, oh, guess what? That equity is not yours.
That's right. That's right. It isn't. We have the same thing here on the other side of fence called farmland preservation. you preserve, and then when you go to sell off trees or lumber, you find out, that's the states. They get a chunk of that change. Oh, gee, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we helped you preserve, and now we've preserved you right out of business.
Yeah, well, see, you know, and that's one of the things that I... I'm preaching to the choir here. You know that anytime the government tells us that they're going to help us, you really, really have to be.
Better watch your wallet.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary. But, you know, I am so proud of the people in Wisconsin. I don't know if you've had any of the folks on from Oregon lately with the 37, with the, they just passed that up there. You should really try and get Larry George on from there. I mean, they had 61% of the vote in the state of Oregon to basically kick the legislation right where it hurts. And what they did there was they said, look, if you're going to take away property rights, that's fine. You want to do that? I mean, you've been doing it through smart growth since 1976. If you want to continue to do that, what you're going to have to do is pay for it. So any time that a person lose any property rights at all, anything, they have to be compensated by the state of Oregon. And they passed that measure, Measure 37 it's called, they passed that measure by 61% of the vote. People around the state are starting to get it. People around the states are starting to understand. It's a slow grinding, but it's slowly. You know what I don't understand is, we have a lot of, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Michael Savage. We have a lot of these folks out there that are all property rights advocates. They all, you know, property rights. But they don't talk about this on their shows.
No, they don't.
I have tried to get some of the leading people in the media industries to address this. And they won't. And it really, really drives me up a wall. So it's great, and it's a wonderful opportunity when people like you, our local radio station WSAU up here, who Michael Shaw had spoke with a couple of times, some of the programming's up there. It's when you get the word out and people hear it, it's the lights go on, and they want to know more. They want to know more.
And that's what it's going to take. It's going to take everybody, because, you know, as many steps as we make forward, that whole agenda makes giant leaps over us a lot of times.
Oh, absolutely. It's an uphill battle, but it's one, you know, it's one worth fighting. My kids, I have 80 acres here, and I have 4 children. If my 4 children came to me in 10, 15 years from now and said, Dad, could we build a house on the land? I said, sure. Well, let me check with my government first. Make sure that you can build. See, and that's how this really all got started.
That's
with
right.
A friend of mine. He's got 80 acres. He's had it since 1860. He has the deed signed by Grant himself.
Wow.
And the planner told him, he said, I don't understand, Dan, why you're so upset. He said, because if all of my children want to live here, I want them to live here. He said, oh, we never said we wouldn't let them live there. We'll let one of them build on your property.
Hmm.
And, you know, so this is the kind of stuff that happens. And, you know, the problem is, see, here we have a law in the state of Wisconsin that's been on the books going on 5 years. Okay. And it's going to get repealed.
Hang on right there. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We have a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back with Greg Swank from Take Back Wisconsin. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Oh, I was just saying that what we have is we have a law that's been on the books for almost 5 years. It's literally almost impossible to change laws. It just seems so hard, but yet we're doing it. You know, I can remember the very first time that I went and testified down at one of the Senate hearing committees on this. Those people down there, those senators and representatives, they hadn't a clue of what we were talking about. They were totally clueless. It isn't just the citizens. It's the state representatives and the senators as well, because it didn't go through the due process. They didn't, you know, some of them had heard about it. They weren't quite sure what it was. It sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's wrong with planning? It sounds great. You know, I kind of heard about it. Do you really understand what it was? No, not really. Gee, I didn't know that. Nine elements, what's that all about? You know, I mean, they really didn't know. And it was wonderful to go to, when we started talking around here, we'd just be a couple of people, and sometimes it was small groups, and then eventually they got to be bigger and bigger. But eventually, who is going to be speaking? Well, tonight we're going to have Greg Swank and Dan Mielke speaking, and also joining us for tonight's presentation is Representative Souter, Representative Petruski, and State Senator Bob Welsh will all be talking about why they are opposed to the smart growth legislation. So we started picking up senators. You start picking up people along the way, and things start to resonate. And not only resonate on the Republican side, it was on the Democratic side as well. People scratching their heads like, how did this one get by us?
Mm-hmm. So, well, sometimes what we've heard is because there is so much funding. You know, they're attracted to the funding, and I know out here there's a lot of very big foundations and, you know, private, quote, nonprofits that throw out those carrots of, oh, well, we'll fund this study and, you know, we'll help fund this group.
Without any funding, this would have never made it. It never would have made it. It would have just been an unfunded mandate, which is what it will turn into even if the governor manages to somehow reinstate it. There still won't be any money, so then it's just an unfunded mandate. And in the state of Wisconsin, if it's an unfunded mandate, nobody moves on it. It's like, you know what? We're tired of this. You want us to do something, you pay us for it. And that's kind of the process. You know, and the sad thing is that it moves from state to state, and it's exactly the same in every state. I don't care if it's Virginia. I don't care if it's Florida. It's the same everywhere. And everywhere you go, wherever smart growth raises...
We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm talking with Greg Swank from Take Back Wisconsin. Go ahead, talk about how... Because, you know, it's here in California. We hear about it in everywhere.
Well, sure. But the thing is everywhere you... Wherever it raises its ugly head, wherever smart growth pops up, there's always this thousand friends group. Have you ever noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin, we never had 1,000 friends of anybody. But all of a sudden, we have 1,000 friends of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I started looking around in smart growth. I'm like, well, there's 1,000 friends of Oregon. There's 1,000 friends of Jersey. There's 1,000 friends of Virginia. There's 1,000 friends of Florida. These thousands, where are they coming
and
from?
And who are they?
Then you go to the Sierra Club site.
Oh, there you go.
You see them all listed there. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
And what really becomes irritating, I argued this with a senator on the floor during one of the hearings. Mr. Swank, you seem to be very articulate and understand this problem that's going on, and blah, blah, blah. However, you know, the fact that it came through the budget is just the way it is. And I said, you know what, Senator? If that's the way business has been, and that's what you're saying, it's business as usual, maybe it's time that we should change the way we've been doing business.
Amen.
And you heard the whole gallery. There was 450 people in that gallery just stand up and applaud. Because this is non-government organizations coming into my state, organizing and creating laws that directly affect me, not my public and representative officials. These are, you know, and they say, well, lobbyists. That's the way it is. Well, you know what? I ran for state senate, and I don't have to have lobbyists in my office. I don't have to deal with them if I don't want to. That's an option that I have. And every senator and every representative down there has that same option. But in this particular case, it always goes back to the fact that it did not get a representative vote. We did not have debates. The public wasn't informed. There was no public hearings. And that's another thing about the smart growth issue. We get the argument with how many people here, you know, we have, if, for instance, if we have 200 people in a group, and I say, how many people here before tonight were invited to come to a smart growth process planning meeting? No hands go up. And the county and the town board members or the county board said, we posted it.
Right.
We posted it. And I said, you know what? Part of the law, part of the comprehensive planning law says that the utmost, first thing on the list is public participation in every step of the journey. And everything that you do, you have to, and if you took the grant money, it's even more imperative that you have to, must include the public. Well, we posted it. I said, then why is it that your meetings, you get two people to show up, and at our meetings, we get 400 people to show up? If we can do it, how come you can't do it? This is out of our own money. This is out of our own pocket. We pay the advertising. We put the word out. You guys post it in the newspaper and pack it on the town board hall door, and you say you've notified the public.
Well, you know, we're getting close to the end here, and I just want to take the time to thank you for, you know, being a real American and all your other folks that are working with you, because you prove it. You know, it's we may be lackadaisical sometimes, but when people lie to us or try to cheat us, we will stand together.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Hey, can you get a quick plug in?
Please.
TakeBackWisconsin.com. Anybody that's interested, www.TakeBackWisconsin.com. You can email me anytime at Greg@TakeBackWisconsin.com. And I'd be more than happy to share any information that I have with anybody at any time. I'm always open to that.
Well, we really appreciate your time, and thank you so much for your work.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Bye-bye.
I just want to remind you that before we go away, the 6th Annual Freedom 21 Conference is July 14th through the 16th at the Nugget in Reno. For more information, for other tools on how to fight back, it's www.freedom21.net. And coming up next, the Part 3 on the War on Reason with Dr. Edwin Vieira and Michael Shaw.
Expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to tonight's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're here tonight and we're going to ask and discuss a very important question facing America today. Many people realize today that something is very wrong with our money. Precisely what is wrong remains largely undefined in most people's minds, because there has been no meaningful public debate on monetary fundamentals in this country for more than half a century. Thus, the public has been denied crucial knowledge of how our system is supposed to work and what has gone wrong. Instead, we've been fed through the schools and the media disinformation concocted by the very people who led us into the verge of trouble. Our show topic tonight is Central Banking, a New World Order, and our very special guest is Dr. Edwin Vieira, who holds 4 degrees from Harvard, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a PhD, and a law degree. He has successfully argued a brief cases leading to landmark decisions at the United States Supreme Court. He has written numerous monographs and articles in scholarly journals, and has written a book on money called The Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution. It is the most comprehensive study in the existence of American monetary law and history viewed from a constitutional perspective. So with me tonight is Dr. Edwin Vieira. Ed, are you there?
Yes, I am. Well, my pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're very happy to have you here. This is our continuing series entitled The War on Reason. And there's no way we can address that subject fully without looking at the core of what makes a society operate efficiently, effectively, and honestly. And if you don't have an honest money system, you can't do those things that a healthy society, would want to be able to do. So tonight we're going to talk about the American monetary system, and I don't know of anyone better to do that with than you. So thank you very much for being here. Let's start with the question of what is money?
Basically, money is a medium of exchange. It serves the function of simplifying and making more efficient transactions in society. Otherwise, your alternative would be to barter one good or service for another, and that's a very cumbersome process, because what you have to barter, you may not be able to find someone else who wishes to exchange at that moment. And money serves an intermediate role. It allows you to sell a particular good or service now, to hold money in what the economists call a cash balance, until the particular good or service that you eventually want to have comes on the market, or you find it at the price that you're willing to pay. So it's a method for making market transactions more efficient, and it's really a method for making market transactions highly rational, because as soon as you have a monetary economy, monetary prices are generated. And these prices tell people what the value of goods and services are. They tell entrepreneurs and capitalists and workers which areas of production they should go into and which areas of production they shouldn't, because of the profitability or unprofitability of those areas. So that directs resources into the areas that are most useful to society, and money provides the mechanism for doing all of that.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're back now at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira, and while some stations take a break from our broadcast, we will continue our discussion. So let's pick up on that point regarding the nature of money.
Well, the point is fundamental that money is the mechanism that allows for what economists call rational economic calculation. It allows for the setting of prices, objective prices. It allows, through the price mechanism, for resources to be diverted from uses of less value to uses of higher value. And so it enables society to maximize production and maximize wealth. If the monetary system is functioning in a rational free market manner. And there's exactly the problem that has developed throughout history is that at some stage, some participants in the system, and usually they tend to be people who are in positions of governmental power, that is, the ability to use coercion lawfully, think that it's to their advantage to manipulate the monetary system so as to transfer wealth from the market, from people out there, common people, into their own hands or into the hands of the governmental apparatus. And that then results in a what I would call a politicization of money. Money now becomes not simply a free market mechanism, but a political mechanism. And to the extent it becomes more a political mechanism, it loses its ability to function as a free market mechanism, and that generates all sorts of economic and then eventually social and political problems. And that's what we're seeing actually in this country. It's the history of the 20th century, the 19th century, the 18th century. I mean, you can go back as far as you want and find very, very significant examples of this debauchment, if you will, of the monetary system for political reasons occurring. And in every instance, it has resulted in real detriment to the societies in which it's happened.
Well, and of course, once the money becomes debauched, the other systems that rely on an honest money system become debauched themselves. And in fact, in our show opening this series, Dr. Michael Kaufman showed how the free market is being debauched through a political process in regards to America's rural lands and natural resources. Mm-hmm. So it all tends to come back together as a reflection of the legitimacy or morality even of that system of money, because that's where it begins. And we're going to welcome our audience back here in just a moment here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're here with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira, who has been describing for us how the monetary system can be politicized, and when it politicizes, terrible things happen to the society where that has occurred. And with that, let's keep talking about where we are and what this introduction has to do with America today.
Well, where we are is essentially in the terminal phase of politicization of the monetary system. We go back to the beginnings of the United States as a political entity. We're talking, of course, of the formation of the Constitution in the late 1700s, 1787, 1789, that period. And the Founding Fathers had had a fair amount of experience with both paper currencies and what economists used to call hard currencies, that is, silver and gold coinage systems. They had that experience during the colonial period and during the War of Independence. And one of the things they had learned, certainly during the War of Independence, was that the paper money system, or what they called in those days bills of credit generated by governments, was a very unstable system both economically and politically. And it led to grave difficulties during the War of Independence itself and immediately thereafter. A tremendous amount of economic instability and political and social instability resulting from it. So when the Constitution was drafted, they were very careful. And again, we have to remember that these are people who had this experience themselves. When they were in the Continental Congress, many of the Founding Fathers were in favor of using paper currency during the War of Independence, and they learned their lesson. Perhaps one of the few examples of where a large political leadership class really learned its lesson from some bad things that it did. In any event, during the Constitutional Convention, they came to the conclusion that they had to remove from the powers of government, both at the state level and at what they called the general government, the national level, what's called the federal government today, at that level, the ability to generate governmental paper currencies. And they did that in two ways. They took the power away from the states to emit bills of credit, and they failed to give power to Congress, or they refused, I should say, because it was proposed, to give that power to emit bills of credit to Congress. And they removed that proposal from the table. So if you read the Constitution in light of the debates that describe what went on, and certainly in light of the previous history, it was clear that neither the federal government nor the state governments were to exercise any power to generate a governmental paper currency. The governmental monetary system was to be based upon silver and gold, the unit being the silver Spanish mill dollar, so-called piece of eight. That's what the title of my book derives. Pieces of eight were the Spanish dollars that circulated in the colonies, and that was the unit with which the colonial merchants and others in the free markets were most familiar, and that was the one that was adopted on the recommendation of Thomas Jefferson. Most people don't realize that, but Jefferson recommended that during the Continental Congress, and Jefferson and Hamilton, when they were both in Washington's administration, one of the few things they agreed on was that monetary system of gold and silver coinage based on the silver dollar as the unit. So that's where the system started, and it was intended to depoliticize money, not to allow the government to manipulate what the substance of money was going to be by generating some kind of paper currency, especially a paper currency that would not be redeemable in gold or silver coin, and then to generate a great deal of that so you would have inflation, which they had seen, founding fathers had seen in tremendous amounts during the War of Independence, so they were very familiar with that. So to limit the government, to depoliticize money, the only money that the government would be allowed to use would be free market money, gold and silver coinage. And the government's only connection to that coinage was that the mints would stamp it. And the reason that they wanted to do that and allowed that to happen was because a stamp on a coin is a certification of its content.
Well, yeah, a best housekeeping seal of approval.
Essentially, that's right. It makes the coin circulate that much more easily. Then people don't have to test them in some way, chemically or otherwise, to determine what their content is. And it was believed at the time that if the government were limited to that function of taking gold and silver from the market, and in those days anyone could bring his gold and silver to the market and have it coined essentially at cost, there would be no loss to him. The government would put its stamp on that coin. $1 was going to contain 371 and a quarter grains of silver, and they had another set of gold coins, which were called eagles, and they had specific weights. You would know, based upon the stamp on that coin, what its content was, and that would then facilitate free market transactions.
Well, those of us who believe in the institution of a legitimate government certainly would be hard-pressed to argue that government doesn't have a role in weights and measures.
Thank you. The weights and measure provision is right there next to the coinage provision in the Constitution itself. So that's the way the founders were looking at it. And that, of course, had been the history of Anglo-American law going back as far as you want to go to the first time that coins appeared in Britain. So that was the initial plan. Now, there was not to be an outlawry, if you will, of all paper money. Private banks were to be allowed to generate paper currencies. Because paper currencies ultimately are simply debt instruments of the bank. It puts these things out, and if people want to circulate them in the private market, of course, that's their own business, and they take the risk, as it were.
But that bank has to have something standing behind
it. That's right. And if it doesn't make good on its notes, if it doesn't pay them on demand, or depending on what the terms may be, and on demand or monthly or whatever, then the bank is subject to, of course, bankruptcy proceedings or charges for contract violation or fraud or what have you, depending on the culpability of its officers. But that was to be the division. The free market might generate other forms of currency through private banks or other instrumentalities. They'd be subject to the laws of commerce and the laws of fraud. And the governments at the state and national level were solely performing this night watchman function, if you will, of certifying that the coinage contained gold or silver to a particular weight. Now, that's the point at which politicization begins to come in. And really, it's in the person of Alexander Hamilton here, if you will, picking one particular famous founding father. He was very concerned about bringing the financial powers in the marketplace into some kind of symbiotic or relationship or partnership, political partnership, if you will, with the government. He thought that was the best way to stabilize the government, and those were the people that you wanted to be in an influential position. And the way he saw to do this was to create some kind of governmentally chartered bank. So you had the first bank of the United States that Hamilton proposed and finally put in. The states did the same type of thing for the same reason.
Excuse me, but basically you're saying that in an era, a political era, where the separation of business and government was very clear in the minds of most of the founders' heads, we had at least Alexander Hamilton suggesting the first public-private partnership, and it had to do with money.
With money, that's right. That's where this thing came in.
And of course, today, that's what we're seeing.
We're seeing it in many other areas.
I mean, from land use to parenting to everything else, now it's suddenly a federal state or a federal-private partnership or a federal NGO partnership. So we've taken this model that began early in the nation's history of privatizing, if you will, for the benefit of some insiders. Money, we now do that with most all of our human activities as we accelerate that in this period of time very rapidly through all sectors of our society. But let's get back to the money dynamic.
Okay, well, and you see, that's an extrapolation of that idea. And the reason it came in first was the old rule, follow the money. Right? This was a way of creating a partnership between rich people in the private sector and politicians. And Hamilton saw, as it were, the percentages in it, if you will. And as I was saying, it also occurred at the state level. Well, the first bank in the United States was highly controversial. It eventually, its charter ran out and it wasn't renewed. A second bank in the United States was put in, and most people are aware that Andrew Jackson, when he was president, was decidedly against this public-private partnership concept, especially in the area of banking, because that kind of a public-private partnership is a way to redistribute wealth generally to the disadvantage of most people in society. And so Jackson fought the Second Bank of the United States. Its charter was not renewed. So for a period of time from the mid-1830s up until the Civil War, there was no governmentally chartered national bank or what we would call today a kind of central bank mechanism. There was nothing of that kind. There were state-chartered banks. Many of them had very bad experiences in terms of they were run into the ground economically. So there was, in this country, the idea of separation of bank and state was still something that I would say a majority of the people were in favor of, and certainly at the national or the federal level, it was the ruling ethos of the time. Comes the Civil War, and again, follow the money is the rule. The Union Congress was facing a very serious problem. He had a secession of the southern states, this war that began. How were they going to finance it? And taxation, at least initially, was out of the question because the war was not terrifically popular politically. So they were afraid to raise taxes to the really astronomical levels at that time that they would have needed to finance the war. So they took two steps, critical steps. Number one, they generated the first governmental paper currency since before the Constitution, the so-called greenbacks. Governmental paper money, irredeemable in gold, and legal tender, which meant that everyone had to take them in trade. So that was the first thing, putting the government into the paper money business. The second thing was the creation of the so-called national banking system. This, again, was a private-public partnership, and if you read the legislative debates on it, the proponents of the national bank come right out and say that. They say precisely, this is what we're doing. We want the financially powerful people, the financially elite group in this country, to be on board with the government, to be in a partnership with us in the generation of paper currency. So they gave people, private parties, the opportunity to buy government bonds and then to use those bonds as the basis for generating their own private banknotes. So you had two streams now of paper currency coming out that were sanctioned by the national government. One directly from the Treasury, the greenbacks, and the other indirectly from the Treasury through the purchase of bonds coming out through
right
private banks.
Right back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz to keep this rolling. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station, and again we're going to carry on our conversation with Dr. Edwin Viara right through this commercial break for some stations. And what we've got is clearly this combination of financial interests with political interests, and of course the first thing we can expect that partnership to do is to fool the people by saying they're going to redistribute for the benefit of the less well off. But who really benefits from a system of government-private partnerships when it comes to money?
Well, let's just take one more step in the history, because of course the national banking system was not really a central bank. It didn't have a capstone to the pyramid. And comes 1913, and they created that in the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve was really the perfection of this system that found its origin in the Civil War, Union Congress legislation in the Civil War.
Now, if you ask who benefits from this system, the answer is the first people in the feed chain, if you will. Let's give an example, a counterfeiter. Counterfeiter generates some paper currency, and he goes out and he spends it. Let's say he buys some jewelry or whatever. He goes off, and he has the full benefit of that counterfeit currency because he's gotten this jewelry and he's disappeared with it. At some point down the line, as the jewelry store spends that money and somebody else spends the money, eventually it gets this to a bank or someone else who looks at it and says, wait a minute, this isn't good. This is counterfeit money. And then whoever is holding that money loses the full value of it. All right? So the counterfeiter is a redistributor of wealth. He generates paper currency, puts it out into the marketplace, he gets the full benefit, some other people in that chain may get the full benefit, but somewhere down the line, somebody loses everything. Now, paper currency that comes out of a, quote, legitimate, unquote, bank runs the same way. The bank takes the money and loans it to some individual, say, business venture. He goes out and he spends it to buy cement or whatever he needs to put up his factory. He's getting the full value of that money because the market is not yet aware that there's more money in circulation today than there was yesterday. Slowly, as that new money begins to percolate through the economy, the market becomes aware of that. Says, oh, there's more money now than there was yesterday, and prices start to go up. Somewhere down the line in the chain of spending, there's some poor devil whose prices go up. He has to spend more for his normal consumption than he would have otherwise, but his wages haven't gone up.
Well, that's all of us.
Well, no, there are some people whose wages go up pretty fast because they're tied to cost of living escalators and so forth. There are some people, congressmen are that way, all right?
Well, but inflation is not the rise in the cost of living. It's the increase in the amount of money in circulation. We can have our cost
that's
down
right,
because
but I'm
we're importing
at the,
cheap labor.
Right, but I'm looking at the price structure. So there'll always be somebody down there, somewhere in this chain of spending, who will find his prices have gone up. He has to spend more money for the same amount of goods and services, but his income has not gone up.
Okay.
So he has lost some real wealth. He has the same amount of income, but he's not able to buy as many goods and services. His standard of living has gone down. And that's what the inflationary mechanism of banks that create new money out of nothing accomplish. They are redistributors of wealth. The ones early in the chain who receive the money from those banks, and of course the banks, because they're making an interest payment on this, right? They're receiving interest, in addition to repayment of principal. Those people that are early on in the chain end up getting the full value. Somebody else pays the cost of that, and there's overall a redistribution of wealth. We can't always tell who it is, because it's a very complicated mechanism as money percolates through the economy.
We're going to welcome our listening audience back in full here in just a moment. We're here with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show discussing the Federal Reserve and monetary policy in the United States. And during our last break, Dr. Vieira has described how the Federal Reserve is the capstone on the system of government-private partnership with respect to money. The Federal Reserve in this country came in 1913. And he's described how counterfeit works to the disadvantage of the last guy in the line who's holding fake money, but there are beneficiaries in between. And he likens that to the Federal Reserve System in that money is simply created out of air, and the loser is the society that is affected adversely by inflation, which of course is most citizens. And the gainers are the first ones in the cycle of the use of that newly created money. Let me ask you this question, Ed. What's the dynamic for the Federal Reserve and its members itself with respect to the creation of this money, which comes out of the banking system? Is there
you have to remember, the Federal Reserve is a very complicated organization, and it's a pyramidal structure. You have the Board of Governors at the top. They're appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. And then right below the Board of Governors, there are 12 Federal Reserve banks, regional Federal Reserve banks. And then below them, as members of those federal, or stockholders, as they call them, of those Federal Reserve banks, are thousands and thousands of so-called member banks, which are private banks. They're national or state banks that are owned by private parties. And those are the folks that, as it were, are making something off of this deal in the private area, because the whole system is designed to float their currency and to provide credit to the currency that the system generates. The ultimate credit is provided by the Treasury of the United States, because the statute that authorizes the emission of Federal Reserve notes says they will be redeemed in lawful money at Federal Reserve banks or at the Treasury of the United States. So if the banks were to fail to pay, then the Treasury would have to pay. That is, the people of the United States would have to pay. So the theory here is that the Treasury has, in essence, of Congress, that passed the statute, has, in essence, loaned the credit of every American to this banking cartel. And theoretically, if the banking cartel is run improperly or negligently or incompetently or what have you, and it collapses, then the full burden of the loss falls onto the taxpayers. That's a nice deal if you can get it.
Heads I win, tails you lose?
Yeah. But you see, that goes back to Hamilton's principle of making this partnership between the political sector and the financial sector, and the financial sector was clever enough to say, well, we don't want, only want a partnership, we want to be bailed out, we want a guarantee that if we lose everything, you're going to pick up the loss. You and the political sector will pick up the loss, and the political sector says, fine, because the banking system enables the political sector to, as the expression goes, monetize public debt. So the government can turn around when it wants to spend for some new program, it doesn't have to go to the taxpayers and ask for unpopular taxes. It can go to the banking system and say, oh, here are some public debts that we're going to generate, and we want you to buy these public debts directly and put new money in our checking account, our governmental checking account, so that we can spend for this program or that program. Now, the average person who sees taxes increase, he doesn't like that, but the average person doesn't understand how the burden of public debt functions as against him, and how it harms society probably much more than taxes does, or the taxes do. Because taxes, you know what the burden is, you know when it has to be paid off. This public debt concept is one that constantly puts off to the future generations, the ultimate payment of the debt. That's why you can have a multi-trillion dollar debt. It's because the person today doesn't feel that as a burden. We're paying the interest on it, but the ultimate principal payment, who knows when that's going to come due? And who knows who's going to pay it? And that's the frightening part about it from a political point of view, that you're putting off on future generations a burden as to which they have had no say whatsoever. You want to talk about taxation without representation. The piling on of essentially infinite debt must be worse from a philosophical and moral point of view. Because these folks that are coming down, my children and my children's children, they've had absolutely nothing whatsoever to say, and they're going to be born into a society that will have $15, $20, $30 trillion with a governmental debt, unpayable debt.
Well, how is it that the society, and we're going to come up on another break here in about a minute, but how is it that society lost its ability to trade with straight money, gold and silver coin? How did we get in the predicament where our money system and really our future, in the political context at least, as you just described, is now more dependent upon a system we have no control over?
It was the fault of the system. All right, that's the real quirk here. It was the fault of the Federal Reserve System. If you go back to 1913, 1914, when the system came into effect past the end of 1930. Federal Reserve notes were originally redeemable in gold coin. They no longer are.
And we'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our guests tonight discussing the Federal Reserve and constitutional banking. Our guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira. And let's continue with that idea how, beginning in 1914, the system itself took away constitutional money, which you've already described.
Right. Now remember, with the context here, we have the public-private partnership that is embodied in the Federal Reserve. And to sell the Federal Reserve to the American people, the politicians said, well, these notes that the banks will put out, this paper currency, will be redeemable in gold, and the banks will be required to have 40% gold reserve for the paper currency they generate. What was not covered, however, was what they called deposit currency, that is, checkbook currency, right, which actually forms the largest portion of the so-called money supply. And the Federal Reserve was touted as a scientific mechanism to end depressions and inflationary periods. Because they had a lot of problems with fractional reserve banking, especially in the 19th century, and the Federal Reserve was supposed to solve this problem.
And yet within 20 years, we were in a depression.
Well, a lot earlier than that. The first one they had was 1920 to 21, the depression followed World War I, but the big one came in 29 through 32.
And inflation certainly has been the case perennially since its
inception. Well, it comes 1932, and here, I would call this one of the great historical breakpoints, because if someone had come forward and explained to the American people that the reason they had this collapse was because of the fractional reserve banking system and public-private partnership, the problem could have been solved. And it's interesting because Franklin Roosevelt ran on a platform of a sound currency at all hazards. That's an exact quote from the Democratic platform of 1933.
Wow.
Sound currency at all hazards. Well, what he did was, as soon as he came in, he closed the banks, he seized people's gold, he went off the domestic gold standard, and he actually gave more power to the Federal Reserve than it had had beforehand. So that was the first step in removing sound money entirely from the system. Now you had a currency that, at least domestically, was not redeemable in gold at all. It was redeemable internationally because you had foreign affairs problems with other countries who were going to accept an irredeemable currency. You still had silver circulating in the system, just as it had since the late 1700s. Well, that situation went on through World War II, and World War II left the United States in the premier financial position in the entire world. Federal Reserve note was the world reserve currency under the Bretton Woods Agreement. But there was a large inflation that went on in the late 50s and 60s, throughout the 60s, of course, with Johnson, with the promotion of the guns and butter program for the Vietnam War, right? We're going to spend on the Vietnam War without raising
taxes.
We're
going to be right back, Dr. Vera, with the rest of our audience, so hold that thought for just a moment. We're back with our guest, Dr. Edwin Vieira, who has described how in the 30s, in order to save the currency on a platform pledge, the executive administration under Franklin Roosevelt confiscated citizens' gold and took us into the second depression since the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And the system of the Federal Reserve was sold to the citizenry as the methodology which would and depressions and inflation. And
right.
Of course, we've had booms and busts all along, and we've had massive amounts of inflation, which Dr. Vieira is describing really started to set sail in the 1950s. And with that, let's proceed.
Well, Johnson's inflation, Lyndon Johnson's inflation during the Vietnam War period, was so great that when Nixon came in, Nixon had to stop international payments of gold. Redemption of Federal Reserve notes. So you see the sequence. And the sequence was not, the sequence was first, the goal was to back the Federal Reserve note. That was supposed to give us stability. The Federal Reserve system was inherently unstable, led to the Depression. Roosevelt comes in, and instead of changing the system in the direction of stability, he gives it, makes it more unstable by removing gold domestically from the system. Johnson comes in, spends a huge amount of terrific inflation, and Nixon now, instead of taking the right action to make the system stable, he makes it more unstable by removing the international payments of gold. So now we have, on the one hand, the Federal Reserve note, which is irredeemable in gold. You could still get silver with it for a while. Johnson actually removed that in 67 to 68. So by the time Nixon has taken this action in 1971, you now have the first time in American history that there is a paper currency generated by this cartel, private-public partnership, which is totally irredeemable in anything of value. All right? It's a promise to pay for which the government will pay you nothing, except another piece of paper. Well, this is a kind of unprecedented situation in world history, but it seems to be chugging along because fundamentally people don't understand the inherent instability and danger in it. And that's what we're facing now, is once you have a system that is not tied to the monetary system, banking system, not tied to the market, that has no requirement that the bank's circulating currency be redeemed in anything necessarily other than another piece of circulating currency. You know, change a 5 for 5 ones, change 2 tens for 2 fives. But you have no connection to gold or silver, as was the history of paper currencies before 1971, going all the way back to the Bank of England and even back to even some earlier banks. Now there is no anchor limitation on the expansion of the currency system, because the banks don't ever have to worry about redeeming that currency with anything. So they can expand as much as that public-private partnership wants to.
Well, and what we get from that, it seems to me, you talked about Lyndon Johnson and the massive spending during his presidency. Well, that was in large part to make war. And yet, we move forward to today, where in large part, that extra spending that is manufactured out of the air, as you, I think you're describing it, is spent on not just war, but on buying up all the resources across this land from the citizen owners and putting it into, again, public-private partnerships with the money that is created by a public-private partnership. Pretty soon, we're all going to become vessels of a public-private partnership, it seems to me, if that pattern continues.
I would say that that's the tenor or goal of any one of these paper money machines. If you run them out to their logical conclusion, theoretically, the man in control of the paper money machine can gain ownership of all private property because he can buy it up.
Well, and that's really, if we reflect on age-old political adages, I mean, as old as Isaiah, the notion that all the people's riches can be gathered if you simply blow the boundaries and raid the public treasury. And a system of paper money allows you to raid the public treasury while you go ahead and politically blur the boundaries and gather up all the riches. And that's why citizens, going back to our conversation Dr. Michael Kaufman, that's why our conversation ends with the notion on that subject that if you're approached as an American landowner or resource owner with a government-private partnership offer for free money in exchange for a conservation easement, you simply turn it down. It's gotten to the point where our failure, our refusal to participate in these public-private partnerships is becoming essential in order to avert victory against reason. And of course, that's what our series is focusing on.
And you notice in this system that the key to the thing is the ability of the public-private partnership group to come into the market with this purchasing power, if you will, this new money. How, if you didn't have the banking system providing this new money out of nothing, would the public-private partnership or simply the government have to raise the funds? Well, it would have to go to the taxpayers. And then it would have to lay on the table why they needed this money. There has to be a program. We need to raise so much money through taxation to do the following things. And one could imagine that most of these things we're talking about would not prove to be very popular. People would not be willing to pay the exorbitant levels of taxation to achieve these New World Order goals. But the average person doesn't understand that money is being generated through the banking system, or the way it's being generated, the consequences of it being generated. And of course, then the government's able to enter the market, or the public-private partnership is able to enter the market with this purchasing power without the onus of having to satisfy the taxpayers of the justification of the program to begin with. It's fascinating because it really undermines not only the ultimate result, but it undermines the whole democratic process, the whole process of representative government, because once you allow the government and these government public-private partnerships to be independent of having to come back to the taxpayers with some justification for what they're doing, then the taxpayers become irrelevant. Well, the voters become irrelevant. The bureaucracy is the only thing that counts anymore, the bureaucracy and the banks.
Well, here in Santa Cruz is an example of the country because our model is going across the country pursuant to the federal government's commitment to sustainable policies. But we have 400 tax-funded nonprofits in this town. We have deficits at the state level, deficits at the local level, deficits at the federal level, and nobody cares. Everyone lines up within this dependency line to take the public-private partnership monies, the grant funds that are sweeping all aspects of how community living is arranged here. So it's much more than an economic dynamic for future generations. It is now to the point, as you've suggested, that the voter becomes irrelevant, the elected representative becomes irrelevant. It all becomes irrelevant because it gets a life of its own, feeding off the system of money that is handing itself out in exchange for compliance to the New World Order.
And I don't think that there, it was any accident, if you go back historically, that the debate with Jefferson and Hamilton over the first Bank of the United States really talked in these terms. And that was Jefferson's point, that you cannot set up this kind of a system without having these kinds of consequences. He didn't foresee what we are now experiencing in particular. But in terms of the general principle, he understood it. And Hamilton, of course, was on the other side because he wanted the particular result. I don't think he ever foresaw what's happening today or would have been particularly in favor of it, what's happening today. But he was interested in the immediate political goal of creating this financial, this partnership between the financial interests and the political interests, because he wanted to stabilize a strong central government. Jefferson saw the ultimate consequence that government would become essentially a tool of these powerful private interests. And the powerful private interests, because they were controlling wealth redistribution, would ultimately become the governing body of the country, even though they never stood for election. And that's what we see. And the politicians now are essentially puppets. And the strings are attached back to the banking system, the financial system, and the people that are in control of those entities.
Well, and certainly that has its effect. If people say, well, not every politician is controlled by the banking system, but it happens through the operation of the political machine of the Democrat and Republican parties, for which you cannot get elected to their nominations without the party's money, and of course the party's money is tied to the existence of the banking system.
Yeah, I think you have to look at, I don't like the word trend, but you look at the direction in which things are going. And please don't tell me that these politicians are not, in some sense, controlled. They may not understand the element of control that controls them, right? They may not be conscious of the control. They may be, as in a sense, victims or manipulated in the same way a puppet is manipulated, doesn't understand, or a marionette is manipulated, and doesn't understand who's pulling those strings. But the fact is that they continue to propose and vote for and put into effect these programs that are moving essentially in a conveyor belt in one direction. And the direction is a direction that is, if not dictated, it's certainly desired by the upper levels of the financial establishment.
Well, and I think what you've got is that one direction coming from two thrusts. You've got on one side the so-called libertarian privatizer, the public-private partner third-way machinery that so many libertarian organizations have propelled. And on the other side, you've got the socialists behind the Green Movement. Their words sound warm and fuzzy, and they attract a lot of people who aren't socialists, but the political dynamic of the left-wing socialist and the right-wing privateer combines the same end, which is to that end which propels this funny money system for a takeover of the citizens' property.
Well, there's another term here. It comes out to what I would call classical fascism. The fascist system, the theoretical fascist system, was based upon the concept of the public-private partnership. That's what it was. It was the alternative to socialism, in which government controls all production on the one hand, and the absolute free market, in which government has nothing to do with production, and production is all controlled by private entities. Fascism was the middle structure and said, wait a minute, we can't have either one of those. We want a system where the powerful private groups, the efficient private groups, interact in a symbiotic relationship, a partnership relationship with the government, and determine not only economic policy, but political policy. In the classic fascist system, they even had a House of Representatives, if you will, that was made up of representatives of the private entities. Right? And Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, set that kind of a system up here in this country in 1933, the National Industrial Recovery Act. If you lay the National Industrial Recovery Act down next to any theoretical structure of fascism, there's theoretical fascism. It's the same thing. Now, the funny point, or perhaps funny isn't the word, the peculiar point is, that structure is the structure of the Federal Reserve System. It's the structure of the National Industrial Recovery Act. It's the structure of Mussolini's fascist system. It's the structure of theoretical fascism. The Federal Reserve System is fascism in money. And that has spread throughout the economy because it's a driving force.
Well, it's throughout the world.
Exercises so much control.
That's throughout the world.
That's right, yeah, that's throughout the world. And you will see, their goal at some stage is to set up a world Federal Reserve type system. It's very difficult to do because it would generate a certain amount of instability just to create one and say, here it is, we're going to use it. Now, I mean, it has to be done in a gradual sense. The Bretton Woods system for a while had the United States Federal Reserve as the world central bank. The instabilities of the system have now made the United States Federal Reserve probably not the best instrument. You have the European Union, and now you have, of course, the Chinese in Asia. But I think the overall plan is to set up a world system, world monetary system, that looks a lot like the Federal Reserve, except it will be outside of the control of any particular country.
It'll be, again, global rather than national, extremely powerful private interests combining their power, their economic power, with the force of government on a global level.
And it will be supported by the United Nations or whatever is the body at the time and the major countries, because it will promise to monetize the debts of these political entities. And then, of course, all of these political entities will be subject to that entity in the same way. You look at the Federal Reserve System and the terrific power that it exercised over the years, let's say, in North and South America. Why? Because the currencies of Central America, Mexico, the South American countries were really rotting vegetable currencies. They were very poor currencies. Compared to them, the Federal Reserve note currency was a hard currency. So all of those countries in their financial dealings had to pretty much dance to the tune that the Federal Reserve and the financial centers in the United States, primarily New York, called. And the same thing would be true if you had an international, global Federal Reserve system. Then the United States would be in the same position with respect to that as Argentina is with respect to the United States today. That system would then really have global hegemony.
Well, let me ask this question. Is there any place in the world that is not part of this type of paper money system?
Well, they all have paper money systems of their own, and they're all interlocked in one way or another.
I mean, the monetary system that is only backed by a governmental promise.
Yeah, no, and the answer is no, unless you go into the marketplace and look at some of these private currencies that are now developing. Go on to the internet and find places like Gold Money or e-gold and so forth, where they're using a gold unit that's exchangeable over the internet. And it is not a paper currency by any stretch of the imagination. It's an absolute gold unit. The only difference between it and a coin is that it transfers electronically.
Before we get to that, let me ask you this question, too.
Sure.
What effect, you know, for some people, understanding the political dynamic of a paper money system backed only by the promise of government on the backs of its citizens, what besides the political and the obvious economic instabilities, what effect does it have on the social structure of a nature? In a beautiful pamphlet called Why Does the United States Need Constitutional Money, which I recommend for anyone out there, and particularly for high school teachers, because this document is the perfect document for every 15-year-old in America to read. You know, it's something that 45-year-olds might have a hard time understanding, but a 15-year-old with a clear mind would understand this very readily, because right, it applies straight to common sense and pure reasoning. How can somebody get that and then come back and answer the question about the hedonistic effects of paper money in our society?
Well,
we've got 1 minute till our break.
Sure, they can obtain this by just asking me for one. Post Office Box 3634, Manassas, Virginia 20108.
Okay, that's PO Box 3634, Manassas, MANASSAS, Virginia 22110.
20108.
I'm sorry, 20108.
Wait, just ask for the Why Does the United States Need Constitutional Money pamphlet, and I'll have one of those sent out.
Okay, well, for the listeners out there, this is something you really do want to take a look at. It's pamphlet size, 45 or so pages, and we're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. Edwin Gill. We're back for our last few moments, at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station with Dr. Edwin Vieira. And while some stations are on a commercial break, let's continue and talk about the social effects that come with a monetary system such as the United States is today. What would your comments be in that regard?
This monetary system promotes overexpansion of debt. It promotes consumption rather than production, or consumption rather than savings, consumption rather than investment. It promotes very short-term views rather than long-term views. And the example that I like to give is this is a system that is loading unpayable debt on future generations for the benefit of essentially narcissistic and hedonistic consumption in this generation. So if you look at the irresponsibility of just that aspect of it, of essentially making it impossible for some future generation, may not be the next one, but certainly the one after that, some future generation is going to find itself loaded with a level of debt that is unpayable that will result in a catastrophe.
Well, and listeners who are familiar with our show need to understand that this is what propels sustainable development. And the projectionism, just like those who sponsored this system of money promised no more inflation and no more depression, what sustainable development is promising us is quality of life for future generations. Well, the quality of life for future generations with the natural evolution of a money system that is responsible for sustainable development is going to lead us to...
It's going to lead us to something that looks like that makes the depression of the Roosevelt era look like a desirable state of affairs. I mean, you have a debt right now of the order of national government, right? Liabilities and so-called unfunded liabilities of somewhere between $40 and $70 trillion. Depends on how you calculate it and which economist you talk to. But it's unpayable. It's impossible of that size to be paid, which means that when the time comes for those payments to be made, there will be tremendous social consequences, and there will be consequences in the direction of unheard-of instability.
And so how do we deal with this beginning now, with the circumstances it is, with Governor Schwarzenegger promising to reduce California CO2 levels to 80% in 1990 within the next generation or two? And we're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show for more discussion to that critical issue. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show for the last few minutes with Dr. Edwin Vieira, who has explained to us how the money system creates short-term thinking that now has rolled up a debt in this country of between $40 and $70 trillion that future generations are going to have to pay in order to redeem our consumption levels of the last century and the beginnings of this century. And this is happening while every agency of government is rapidly expanding their expenditure of funds so as to implement what I call the new world infrastructure of the post-private property era, where you live in government housing, where resources are off-limits to ordinary human beings, where your jobs are assigned and your transportation alternatives become increasingly limited as the attack on the automobile accelerates. And all of this made possible thanks to the partnership between large private interests and the central power of the federal or globalizing governments. What is it that citizens need to start thinking about in order to make some healthy transition from where we are to where we can be?
Well, for healthy transition to take place, you're going to have to, if not change the present banking system, provide an alternative sound banking system so that the transition can take place. There's no way that this present system is going to be able to correct itself. It may not even be able to correct itself if there's a competitive system. It may just go under. Your perhaps bigger problem is looking at the possibility that a very serious economic crunch, give it whatever name you want, right? It could be hyperinflationary, it could be depressionary, there are all sorts of scenarios, but a very significant economic crunch is going to occur in the not-too-distant future, and what can people do there? I suppose the only answer is to begin to... number one, people have to get out of debt. The only, quote, personal salvation, unquote, from an economic point of view, is to be as debt-free as possible. And then to look at some alternatives in the area of currency, look at some of these private currencies and some of the other alternatives, because if you have a major crunch in the present banking system, look at what happened in the 30s is a good example. Many, many localities were driven to the creation of what they call private scrip, or local scrip. Some of it was generated actually by governmental entities, local government. Some of it was generated by business entities because the banking system simply failed. It wasn't functioning anymore. So that's one thing that people have to potentially look at as a possibility, a failure of the banking system. You look at what happened in Argentina not too long ago, just a couple of years ago. The banks went into crisis. They shut down. They weren't allowing people to take money out. I don't know how the average Argentinian functioned under those circumstances. You had a number of those events. One happened in Maryland, one happened in Rhode Island, one happened in Ohio about 10 or 12 years ago when the state savings and loan systems collapsed. So there are recent precedents for this happening. It certainly is possible that it could happen at a national or even international level. And the grave difficulty is, you remember during the 1930s or some of the earlier banking crises that we had in this country, when the banks collapsed, the monetary system didn't collapse because the banking system was based upon the gold and silver coin system. All the paper money the banks generated was supposedly redeemable in gold and silver. Of course, the banks weren't able to do it, and so that's why they went under. But the monetary system was still there. Now we have no underlying monetary system. There is no gold and silver coin that's just circulating. People have it, and they put it away in the strong box, a safe deposit box or whatever. But you don't see gold and silver coinage circulating the way it circulated in this country even prior to 1933. So if you had a major national or probably international monetary crisis, this country and the whole world might very well be left without any acceptable money. And imagine the consequences from an economic point of view, and then, of course, the social and political consequences that follow from a major breakdown. If you look again at the 30s, you had the economic breakdown of the collapse of the stock market, and then, of course, the banks going under in 1931 and 1932. And as a result of that economic breakdown, there was a terrific social breakdown and political breakdown. Communists, fascists, every kind of crackpot political came out of the woodwork.
Sure.
And then, of course, you had Roosevelt, and Roosevelt did more to drive this country away from constitutional government and in the direction of really all sorts of unsound. And Social Security wasn't the worst of them, thank you very much. But all sorts of unsound things came out of the Roosevelt administration. And Roosevelt was probably, how shall I put this, he was probably the least radical of the radical groups that appeared in that period. Well, what would happen now if something equivalent to the 1932 banking collapse occurred?
Well, what suggests to me is that while that's a possibility, we also need to be thinking about how it is. And we're going to have another show on this, so hopefully we can arrange with you to come back and to talk not just about the crisis breaking down, but how it is we can smooth ourselves out of an inevitable crisis here, now, or later, and into a system where America can transition back to the road of its original vision and onto the road of equal justice and individual liberty, where real money, you know, makes a real honest society. And I want to thank you very much, Ed, for being with us tonight.
Arthur, my pleasure.
Because this is...